So, at least the way that I'm telling the story, King Nebuchadnezzar was still sitting in his throne room more or less the same night that he had given the order that his assassins, his guards, those guys who were the highest in the military, at least should send the guys they're in charge of, out into the fine and glorious set-apart region of Chaldea, where the Chaldean sorcerers held their schools, and in the dark of night, drag them out of bed, slaughter them all where they stand, because they're a bunch of liars. Bunch of liars who say they can speak for the gods and to the gods, that they can enchant and incant and read portents, and they can't even tell me my dream. Ah. Yeah, my whole civilization is more or less built and tied into this. It's very connected with our religion. I don't know what any of it means, but I'm not putting up with any of this anymore. I'm king, and I've been put here to reign, and it's because I'm great that all this is happening. And so we got to find another way through this thing, and it's going to start with a clean slate. A slate cleaned by blood. And so he's sitting there in his room, his throne room, on his big iron throne or golden throne, gold-plated at the very least. He's sitting there fuming and stirring. Maybe he's had a nice cup of coffee brought to him. Maybe not. Maybe some tea. I don't know. But it helps the picture a little bit, yeah. What do you do in the middle of the night when you're angry, trying to figure something out? Where do you go? Where do you sit? How do you think? How do you feel? And then, oh, what was that? I mean, there shouldn't be anybody disturbing me right now, like, because this is when I normally would be asleep. And everyone who I, you know, give orders to, they're supposed to be gone, but, well, come in, right? And in comes this Arioch guy, chief of the assassins. You know, pardon me, sir. But you need to see this. And he drags with him a kid. I mean, not a child, but, you know, 17, 18-year-old kid. A little scrawny, a little thin, but, you know, good-looking thin. Yeah, just he doesn't look like a... He's not a beefcake kind of guy, right? Beefcake. He's young still, right? He hasn't come into the full strength of manhood yet. But he is... beautiful to look at, because all of the young men that and women, right, which are brought from all over the world to Nebuchadnezzar's court are good looking people. So he's stunning, and you know, maybe he rings a bell a little bit. Maybe he's kind of like, wait a minute, I know this guy. We just did that graduation thing a couple months ago, and this was that kid who did so well. Like even his teachers didn't really know what was going on compared to what he could give answers, and in our own knowledge. Well, maybe he recognized that, maybe he didn't, maybe he's just so angry, if you know who, what, who's this? But the kid fixes him with a steely eye. He's not afraid. Why is he not afraid of me? He should be. Yeah? He's not afraid, but so what? He opens his mouth. He said, "Oh, King, I can tell you the dream and its interpretation." Now, this alone had to be a bit stunning to Nebuchadnezzar. Yeah? I mean, he's just had everybody that knows everything say, this is impossible, it cannot be done. And he's sent out his assassins to slaughter them where they stand. And now there's this youth who says he can do it. What do you make of that? How do you even begin to comprehend that? Where does that fit in your secular worldview? Now, the next thing that happens is a little weird, though, too. And this is what makes me think that the king did remember Daniel. So Daniel says, I can tell you the dream, I can tell you its interpretation, but I need to do something first. You just need to give me a little bit of time. A little bit of time, I'm going to go implore to my God, the one who only lets me eat certain things and stuff like that. I'm going to go talk to him, and then I'll come back and give you the answer. But he's not like saying, maybe give you the answer. This isn't like, I hope God answers me. There's a certain ruddy conviction in this guy. So is it the conviction that wins Nebuchadnezzar over? Is it the fact that he knew him and said, well, this guy did all that stuff a couple months ago that was pretty amazing. Well, might as well give the kid a shot. What am I going to lose? The thing is, you know, biding for time is what people do when they're in trouble, right? So I'll pay it back. I swear. Just give me another week, right? Like that kind of thing. So how Nebuchadnezzar didn't think it was just a ploy, a game to escape or to get people out of town. And he's, you know, kind of here. All the wise men are like, look, we can flee if we can. Let's throw him that Daniel kid and he can say he knows. And while they're busy waiting for him, we'll all get away, right? Yeah. I mean, that's where my mind would have gone if I was the king sitting there. But somehow what goes on in that inner chamber is enough that he says, sure, why not? Go home, do what you got to do, come back, let me know. So that's what Daniel does. He goes home. He goes home and he wakes up Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah. Whether he called them by Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, I do not know. But he wakes them up and he says, hey, guys, would you, what do you say you pray with me? Yeah? Let us implore our Lord, because here's what's going to happen. We're all going to get killed unless he lets me do what I've already sworn I have the ability to do by his name, which is to know what the king dreamt and also know what it meant. Now, here's sort of a thing. The older scholars, from what I can tell, believe that Joseph had the ability to interpret dreams before this, that this would not have been the first time this would have happened. And they base this on a verse in chapter 1, where in growing in the wisdom and stature of the Chaldeans, it also does mention that Daniel is an interpreter of dreams. The problem that I have, though, is that that verse alone doesn't really prove that to me. Just like you would call King Nebuchadnezzar even before he became king from a historical perspective, so Daniel grew in the ability to foretell or to understand dreams. Well, it's what's happening right now, right? It doesn't mean that he could do it before this just because it said it goes directly from saying that he could tell dreams into this narrative, right? So, and the fact that he goes home and prays at this point, And the words of his prayer, or his words to his friends about the prayer, lead me to think, I'm not so sure he had ever done this before. I'm not so sure that he knew that he was a dream interpreter. Rather, he's standing upon his conviction that as a Hebrew, faithfully holding to the covenant of God on his behalf, he will receive the benefits and blessings and protections which are given him. He's seen that happen with regard to the food. The miraculous response to the food. And so now he's like, well, God is with us. This is what we believed. God is with us. So let's go ask God with us to get us out of this one too. But maybe this wasn't the first time, maybe not. But listen to the words here. Listen to the words. Chapter 2, verse 17. Then Daniel went to his house and made the matter known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, and told them to seek mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his companions might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. So it's not just like Daniel just can know a dream, hear a dream, whatever. It's not like he's a mutant superpower and he just does this when he wants to. And he does. He goes and he says, hey, friends, like this affects you as well. You should ask for this. You should pray for this here. Seek the mercy of God on our behalf. Now, part of me, the evil part of me, I suppose, really wants to go off and get into my frustrations with American prayer mythology and American prayer magic and how we treat prayer like this, hey, I'll get as many people to pray for me as possible, and then God will say yes. And if you're not careful, I mean, you look at this, you're like, well, that's exactly what he's doing. Well, I don't know. I don't know that's exactly what he's doing. He's sharing his concerns, which certainly when you ask someone to pray for you, you are sharing your concerns with them. You're asking them to seek the mercy of God. That's all fine and good. How this all overlaps and connects to what we call the prayer of the church and the public prayers and the name list on those prayers, which has been a frustration of mine for forever. just this kind of reading off of names. I'm going to leave that alone, even though it's, you'd get me back in raw mentality there a little bit. But what we're to take from this here, I think, is that Daniel, the way I take this, Daniel has never interpreted a dream before. And he has no knowledge that he can. Other than that, when an assassin's blade is at his throat about to kill him, he knows that God is with him. In a special way, remember, this is not New Covenant, this is Old Covenant, special way with extra promises about the present age that we don't have, but they did. And he puts his faith in those things and says, well, God's with me. I can do this. I'll tell the king I can do it. He goes. He tells the king he can do it. He knows God can do it. I mean, that's never the question. It's never the question of whether or not God can heal the sick when you pray for it. The question is God intending to do that? Has God said he will do that? Is that according to the will of God as it's been revealed to you in the scriptures? And the will of God revealed to Daniel in the scriptures is, I mean, he even got some of this from the preacher in Jeremiah, perhaps, is that they will go into exile, but they shall return. And that if they walk with their God, he will walk with them. If their crops will grow, they won't get sick, they'll beat all their enemies. Well, then here we go. Now, the challenge, of course, is that we don't have the crops growing, the not getting sick, the beating back our enemies temporally. We don't have that promise, right? And that's what you don't want to confuse that. And so much of American Christianity, in its best, I'm not talking about the worst of it, in its best, it goes to the Old Testament and it confuses these things. It does not understand the distinction. Not just the people who are worshiping on Saturdays, but the people who would look at this verse, look at these verses, and say, oh, look, oh, dreams and visions, we can do that. Or look, you know, we can get, if we just put our faith and pray to God, then we'll have everything we need given to us. Wow, well, there's a lot more going on here. And this is kind of the other thing that's really, I think, pretty central. To recognize that what's going on here so far is not Daniel's story. It's in the book of Daniel, it's called Daniel. Remember, Daniel's kind of split into two parts, the reality of the world kingdom and then the reality of the kingdom of God. And the story of the reality of the world kingdom, at least early on, the great bulk of it, it's not about Daniel. It's about this guy sitting on the throne in the room, just left him a little while ago, fuming and stirring. It's about Nebuchadnezzar. And it's not about Nebuchadnezzar's fall. It's about Nebuchadnezzar's redemption. We'll come back to that. So he goes to his friends. He says, hey, let's seek God's mercy here, because if God decides to give us up, we're all going to be destroyed, and that's the way it's going to be. Verse 19 is very brief. You know, then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision of the night. So what does that look like? So he comes into the house. Hey, everybody get up. Let us seek God. And what they do is they keep vigil. You know what a vigil is, right? At least historically. You know, somebody really needs an answer from God. And so, I mean, it's like a medieval thing, right? So the knight goes up to the highest tower where there's this altar and these candles, and he gets on his knees and he has his sword out in front of him, and he stares up at some picture or up into the sky, and he watches and he prays and he waits and he waits and he prays and he watches and he waits and he keeps vigil all night long. He is vigilant through the night. He does not sleep, but watches, keeps watch. So that's what Daniel is doing. And in the midst of the night, while he is not asleep, he does not have a dream. In the midst of the night, I would say, God reveals him to be a prophet. God comes to him and gives him a waking vision, not a dream. It's not a perfect one-to-one. It doesn't always line up, but this is important. Dreams, as God's way of revealing things, only generally happen to those who are outside of the covenant. Now, Joseph is a definite exception to this, right? But think of Pharaoh, to whom Joseph reveals the answer of the dreams, right? Dreams don't generally belong to prophets. Prophets have visions. And that's what Daniel gets. He doesn't get a dream. He gets a vision. So God comes and he speaks to him. He shows him exactly what Nebuchadnezzar saw. He tells him all that it means. Daniel comes running out of his vigilant room, tells his friends, hey, it happened. It happened. I have seen what I am to say. And then, this part doesn't always make the movies, then he prays again. He doesn't just pray for mercy. Now he prays for thanksgiving. Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and might, and have now made known to me what we asked of you, for you have made known to us the king's matter. Now, again, there's a lot of language in there that I think reveals this as sort of a, wow, I was expecting this, but this is pretty cool. I'm now able to see things. And then the reflection of the vision itself in the words. Because if you don't know yet, this dream is going to be about the removing of kings and the setting up of kings, the changing of times and seasons. And we'll come back to that, Kairos and Chronos. And even more, the deep and hidden things of God, the revelation of the Christ in his time. I'm not going to spend too much time on that, but it's kind of huge, right? What's gone on in this night? Assassin at the door, knife at the throat, seen the king, got out of seeing the king, came back, held holy vigil, had a walking vision of all the kingdoms of the world, not quite, but awful close. And what do? I say thank you to God. I acknowledge him for being the one who gave this to me. And this will be so much a part of what he says, what he confesses, the good confession that he makes before Nebuchadnezzar, because, as I said just a few moments ago, this isn't Daniel's story. This is Nebuchadnezzar's story. So Nebuchadnezzar is in the throne room again. It's got to be the same day. I mean, we don't have the markings in the text to tell us the time. But Nebuchadnezzar wasn't going to give him a week. No way. Right? So it's the same day or very close to the same day. And so Nebuchadnezzar's there. Maybe it's morning. Maybe he does have his cup of coffee by now. It's like a horrible night. It's like he's got the blanket wrapped around him. He's just kind of like, oh, man, that was a bad night. And some of his servants or some others are there with him. You know, business for the day starts. I don't want to work today. I want to go back to bed. And the door comes open again, and there is my chief assassin, Arioch. He's standing there, and he, this time it's not like quite the nervousness. This time he walks in, and you got to think, I hate to use Game of Thrones again, but you got to think, you know, that big, great hall of the king with all these pillars and all this space for people to stand, and anybody who comes in that's new to the court. The court, like literally the courtroom, anyone who is new to the court is going to be announced. And that's what happens here. This Arioch guy, this assassin guy, he announces Daniel. Now, I'm not going to read it like it reads. I'm going to do it like a fantasy book would. Hand on his sword, chin held high, with all his plumage and vestiges, all of his highest courtly robes, Arioch says, I present before you Belteshazzar, son of David, son of Judah, dream teller, summa cum laude from the house of the Chaldeans. Now, while he's doing this, he might also just happen to have the sword at Daniel's back or at Daniel's throat, right? Like, here he is. This is the guy. He said he can do it. And if he doesn't, you know what comes next. And don't miss this either. This is pretty cool. Do you remember what Belteshazzar means? Daniel's name? I mean, the way we would say it, it means long live the king. Yeah, it's Bel, preserve the king, great god of Babylon, preserve the king, but long live the king. So I present to you, long live the king. That's his name. What are the odds? Yeah, the other guys' names are all just dealing with the gods, but they're not dealing with the king. Belteshazzar is all about the goodness of the king. How much of this is planned? by God himself. Now, with the sword at the side or at Daniel's throat, and Daniel's presented there, I can tell you the dream and its interpretation. And whatever crowd is gathered there is now listening. I mean, maybe you have the other satraps and the enchanters and whatever are there. These heads who are now reliant on Daniel to save them. And yet, remember, this is the guy who like doesn't do it the way he's supposed to. And so no one really likes him quite so much either. You got all that house rivalry thing going on too. Yeah. So they're all there watching this thing. And the king says, I don't think you can do this. Like, what, you? I don't know why he didn't take this approach the first time Daniel was in the room earlier in the night. Maybe he'd had time to think about it. I mean, the way that it reads right out of the Bible is this. The king declared to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, are you able to make known to me the dream that I have seen and its interpretation? I guess you could read that as like, you found it out. But it's got this like, you know, that's why he's back. So it's like, yeah, right. Okay. So everybody, all you guys who also have sores at your throats, are you ready to die? As this is your hope. And you know, I don't buy it, but it's been a fun game. Here, you go ahead, man. Tell me what I dreamed. Tell me what I dreamed, since you're so wise and able. And Daniel's like, not me. And he says, I am not the teller of dreams. I am not the son of any school or house of the Chaldeans. I am a child of the god of Kronos and Kairos. The one who makes all things, the one who reveals mysteries, the one who makes known things that are to be that have not yet come to pass. I am not the teller of dreams, but he is the giver of dreams, and he has told me the meaning of yours. So you know that sound that the wind makes when it's coming through a window? And when that's happening, usually there's other sounds. You might hear a lawnmower, right? You might hear a car go by. I want you to just kind of pretend those aren't there. All you got is that just that light, breezy kind of flapping sound of rising and falling winds. And you know, this the best time that happens is when you're taking a nap, but you're kind of awake, but you're kind of not, and you can kind of feel the wind too. So let's start there. You're lying there and the wind is to be heard and kind of felt. It's almost like the wind rushing across a great plain. It's almost like it's flapping on your clothing against your ears. It's almost like it's more wind than you have ever felt. But it's not that strong. And you notice that it's not dark, it's light. Beyond your eyes, it's day, it's bright day, it's midday. And there's a warmth, there's a heat upon you. And so you finally open your eyes and you notice you are on a plain, a dusty and desert-like plain. Sand around you. You can feel it in your fingers, and again the wind whips as you pull yourself to your knees and you stand. And then you are in terror. Because you are standing at the foot of the largest, most massively chaotic statue you have ever seen. It is so extreme that you are dwarfed in its presence. It towers above you. Now, maybe you have never seen the Statue of Liberty. Maybe you have. I remember the first time I saw it from a distance driving. And it betrays my first world cynicism. I thought, that's it? Because all the pictures of it, right? All the pictures, you think, that thing's just huge. And the thing is, it is huge. But the pictures and the way we've come to expect things to be huge, skyscrapers, right? The Statue of Liberty is not a skyscraper, not the way that they are now. So imagine a statue that's a skyscraper, right? 50 stories, 75 stories. So phenomenally gigantic that you, by this wind-whipped plane, and it are all this there, and it's just dwarfing you. You think it's going to fall on you, or maybe it's alive. Maybe it'll begin to walk and crush you. Indeed, it looks down upon you, and you can see that its head shines with the glory of kings. A glimmering and glistening and perfect golden face with hair fit for a god. But as this majestic presence moves from the phenomenal cut of the chin and the marvelous Mesopotamian beard down to the neck and the chest and the arms, well, now he no longer shines with gold. Now he is silver. Silver is strong. It's a good metal. Useful for many things. And yet, the silver, it stops as well. For by the time that you come past his strong chest and the arms which hold his glistening silver sword, down to the girdle that wraps his waist and his loins and protects him in battle. Well, he shines again, like unto gold, but is not gold. You know, this is brass. And brass, now, this is a strong metal. This is a metal that is, it really changes. You know, bronze really changes the way that battle is done, the way that swords can be made. It's a significant step forward in history to be able to craft things of brass. And even more stunning than that, these brass legs give way to, well, the bottom part of the leg. So you got to kind of understand that the girdle area, the lower gut and the upper thigh were kind of conceived as being the same part of the body in the ancient world. And then the leg really is like knee and below. I mean, it's not a perfect one-to-one either there, but you got to get that idea because it's very much the picture here. And as this gold-headed, silver-sorted, brass-girdled statue looks to move about the world and take all things underneath its feet. Well, those legs that it tramps on are legs of iron. By the time of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, iron was definitely, they were in the Iron Age. They were able to craft things out of iron. And why did they do that? Well, it's plentiful. But it's also stronger. You make a sword out of gold. I mean, I play Minecraft with my kids. You can make golden swords. And at least Minecraft recognizes, like, they're not very good. You know, you get all this work to get some gold, and you make it into a sword, and it kind of is pretty weak and breaks really easy. Gold's not really so good for that. Neither is silver, ultimately, although it's a lot better than gold for this. But they're both more precious because they're more rare. And actually, in the softness that gold has, it can be used in a very spectacular ways. Filigree. You don't make iron filigree, right? It you maybe could today, but you wouldn't then. It would have been harder to do. So the legs are iron, and the feet are iron. But then as you're standing there again, the wind whipping about you, looking at this giant toe that's twice your height, yeah? You notice that the iron there is speckled, a speckled brown. What is that? You go and you look at it and you kind of scratch it with your fingernail and you can actually leave a mark right there because it's just clay. It's iron mixed with clay, which is kind of like oil mixed with water. They don't mix. You can't make a mix. There is no way to actually mix them. You end up instead with just a pile of iron, clay, iron, clay, iron, clay, but there is no fused thing. You can't do it like you can with making iron into steel. Steel is made when you melt iron down and you mix it with other carbon-based elements, and it strengthens it. It's even stronger. Steel is stronger than iron. But clay, it won't even participate in that process. So here you have this, you know, this terrifying thing rising above you and dominant for all the world to see. And yet, here you are beside it and seeing this weak point in it. And just at that moment, you hear something and you dodge to the side behind you and just past your head, it just misses you. There's this little rock, I mean, like a pebble. But it moves flying fast. A bullet's pretty small too, right? It'll do some damage. It flies right past you, misses your head, over your shoulder, and strikes that point where you'd scratched on the toe. And right where it hits where you scratched on the toe, it doesn't just have a little crack. Maybe it does. Maybe that's how it starts. A little crack, but the crack. And it just goes further and further, and it begins to crumble. And you go look up, and you're hearing kind of a large rumble as the weight of the earth is being pushed down now, as the foundation shifts a little bit. So you turn, you start to run. And as you run, you can hear the feet have collapsed, and that, you know, the brass legs are hitting the ground, and then like that sound of a door, you know, falling and collapsing. You can hear it kind of rubbing along the ground as it comes down, even though it hasn't hit yet. And you're sprinting as fast as you can as it falls right behind you. And you turn over your shoulder, and that golden head is coming straight at your face. And then you wake up in your bed. What was that? And then, well, Daniel is standing there, having just said this to that whole courtroom. And who knows what they were thinking. They were looking at it like, wow, that was intense. Well, that was good. I mean, if I had to make up a dream, I don't know if I would have come up with that. That was pretty good. I mean, it obviously it's not what happened, but you know, and then you look and you're like, well, the king's like, his eyes have gone wide. Yeah? Yeah? Because he knows that's exactly what he dreamed. You know, that coffee is sitting there cold because he hasn't touched it. But he is wired right now, watching this kid. Belteshazzar, long live the king, the one who says he speaks to the almighty maker God, the one who says his God is ruler of Kairos and Kronos. Oh, we should come back to that now. Kairos and Kronos, two Greek words. They summarize the two different types of time. Kronos, the old father time image, the one who keeps going no matter what, who ruins all things with his endless pursuit, who none survive. And then Kairos, the season, the harvest, the turning of the days, that which you look forward to. Oh, I love autumn, don't you? And then winter starts to come, and spring is such a joy, and who doesn't enjoy a good summer afternoon? Sleeping on the couch with that window open. Well, not in St. Louis, but elsewhere. Yeah. This kid, long live the king, and his God who says he holds those things in his hands, is now just demonstrated that he does indeed reveal mysterious things. Because who could tell me? Who could tell me? What? No man can tell me what's in my own head. And he just did. Now, Daniel's there too, and you gotta think, I mean, The kid's pretty cool. He can't be too afraid. He knows what's going on. He knows what he saw. He know he had a vision. He knows who his God is. He knows what the scriptures say. But the pressure still had to be pretty immense. Whether the sword's at his throat or not, it is, figuratively speaking, at his throat. The whole crowds are there. And he's watching the king, like, his eyes go wide. Now, was there ever a moment within his head where he thought, man, I wonder if the king thinks I'm making this up, if maybe this isn't right. But I gotta keep telling the story. It's what I know. Here we are. Trust the Lord. Yeah. Or was the whole time he was just watching the king's eyes go wide, and it's like, yep, it's right. It's right. My God is God. I don't know. I fancy it's some of both of those things. My own saint-sinner experience is an ever-present battle between light and darkness within me, and I'll fly back and forth between confidence and extreme doubt. Well, that was the dream, O King. Now, I don't think you really just want me to tell you that, right? Because that's the part that bothered you. I don't know if the interpretation will not bother you, but I can tell you what it is. By the way, I should just have this aside here, too. The word interpretation is really not a good word. Interpretation is a word that comes out of postmodern thought, American thought. And it's about how knowledge only comes between things, right? So there's the Bible, and there's me, and then there's my interpretation of it. And I interpret, right? I'm the one who gives it meaning. The in-between inter is there. As opposed to a much better word, understanding. Right? So if I understand the Bible, it's not my understanding. Right? The word under, I stand beneath it. The understanding of it is the truth of the matter. So here, O King, let me tell you the understanding of your dream. Let me tell you, O King of Kings, that you are indeed the King of Kings. And what that means for you and those who will come after you. Now, don't get too wigged out by the fact that Daniel actually does call him King of Kings. That was a very common turn of phrase for ancient Near Eastern kings to give themselves when they got strong enough. The Persians particularly will do this. So Cyrus, who comes later, Xerxes. King of Kings was like the name of their primary title, because they were. They were kings who had subjugated other kings, and those other kings remained kings but paid tribute to them. Right? Assyria had done the same thing. So not too big a deal here. But also that Nebuchadnezzar is very much a King of Kings in a more time-oriented way. That's really what this vision's about. And then, and we have to jump ahead here a little bit. I hate to burst the bubble early. But he's King of Kings because he is also a picture of Christ. He is a picture of Christ, not by means of his own sacrificial death or anything like that, but by means of being the king who brings mankind and kingship out of madness and paganism and into faithful trust and truth. Now, it happens to him. He's going to become a Christian. That's what this story is about. Nebuchadnezzar's conversion. Yeah? Nebuchadnezzar's becoming a Christian. That's what we're really dealing with over the course of several chapters here. But in that then, as King of Kings, as the ruler of an empire from which other empires will come, none of which will have Christian kings, he is greater than them all, and a picture then of the Christ who reigns over the kings of the world who do not believe in him. You know, kiss the Son, O kings, lest ye be angry, Psalm 2, all that kind of stuff. So anyway, that King of Kings, it has a number of different edges there, and of course you're going to pick up on the fact that it is in the title that's given to Christ, King of Kings and Lord of Lords, because he's the only one, really, that holds that title eternally. So, to tell the interpretation, and I don't know that I can get as exciting in the understanding, see how I just did it there? I don't know that I can get as exciting in the revealing of the understanding as I did in the dream itself. And I know you probably know a good part of this, because this is one of the most told visions out of Daniel. But he tells the king that the golden head is him. And it doesn't mean just Nebuchadnezzar. He means Babylon, the empire of Babylon that has arisen. And again, you got to see this a little bit as Babylon being a picture of Christ as the great ruler of the eternal kingdom, just in the language. You, O King, the King of Kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power and the might and the glory, sound like the Lord's Prayer, anybody? And into whose hand he has given, wherever they dwell, the children of man, the beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens, making you rule over them all, you are the head of gold. Yeah? Now, you might say this is a little bit of Adam as well. You get the stewardship of the earth with the ruling over the birds and the field and all that. That's very much right out of Genesis 1 and 2. So Nebuchadnezzar is representing that as well. The head of gold, which ultimately is going to fall. Yeah? Now, he doesn't say much more than that. He doesn't really give an explanation of the gold. In fact, with most of this, there's not a lot of explanation. Aside from telling us who these kingdoms are, we don't get too much more. And there's even a little bit of a debate about it. I'm going to go out on a limb and really disagree with the best answers that I've been able to find so far in terms of what the distinctions between gold and silver and brass and iron really mean. Why is Nebuchadnezzar gold? And why after him shall rise up another kingdom that is the silver, the arms, the two arms of silver? And Daniel's very, very clear right off the bat. Look, after you, there will be this silver kingdom. Inferior to you, they are. Yeah? And yet a third kingdom, brass, that shall rule over all the earth. But see, so the hang-up here is, so what's the inferior about? Well, the thing is, everything that comes after Nebuchadnezzar has to be inferior, because the bronze is going to be inferior to gold, right? The iron, so far of its value and its understanding, I mean, is as valuable as iron is. You get a lot of iron for a little bit of gold, right? Even though it's better for fighting with, it's not better for everything. So this fact that everything which comes after is inferior to Nebuchadnezzar is the question. And but see, he only says that the silver is inferior. And he talks of the bronze one as ruling over all the earth and of the iron one as breaking and shattering all things and crushing things, right? So is the inferior about everything? I say yes, but that's not what, at least the guys I read, what they say. They say that it's only the silver one that's inferior to the gold. And then they try to figure out how that is. And they go into the fact that the Medes and the Persians, which are the next kingdom, the silver kingdoms, the Medes and the Persians, that they're actually two kingdoms kind of working together, that they're a divided house, right? And that they'll even say it's there's two arms. They're represented by two arms on the statue. There's two parts of the kingdom. But if you knew anything about it, that doesn't make sense to me. These guys are smarter than this. Cyrus did not have a divided kingdom, nor did Darius, nor did Xerxes. These guys ran the show. It was very straight up. And so I just don't buy that the inferiority is that the Nebuchadnezzar just had a better grip on the kingdom and that the Persians just weren't as organized. Maybe I'm misrepresenting the argument here, but I'm going to go way out on this limb here and say the inferiority of the silver and the bronze and the iron and the clay is the thing that makes them not connected to the real King of Kings, the power and the glory and the might. This is about the conversion of Nebuchadnezzar, and he is the greater kingdom because he will be the Christian king. And everyone who comes after him, ruling the world powers, he is the Christian king ruling the world power, which is the enemy of God. That's crazy, but it is true. Whether you like my interpretation or not, it is true that Nebuchadnezzar will be a Christian king ruling over the world power that also at the same moment is the enemy of God, holding the people of God in exile and keeping the temple sacrifices from taking place, taking the seed out of the land so that the Christ cannot come. He's both these things. But he will be by the end of this a believer, and that the Cyrus will not be, not that we know of, nor Xerxes in Persia. And then the bronze, that's Greece, right? And we're going to get way more into these other kingdoms, particularly the Persians and the Greeks. They're going to come back in other visions. So this vision does also serve very much as a setup. It's just sort of like an introduction to these four kingdoms, and these four kingdoms are coming back, and we're going to look at them from more closely in a number of different levels, and but particularly the second and third, but all of them will be. So we mentioned then the bronze. This is that which shall rule over all the earth, and you got to think then immediately. And most scholars agree on this, at least until the modern day when skeptics doubt everything. Most scholars would say, well, think about Alexander the Great. Right? What did Greek culture do? Why is it that the Romans spoke Greek? Right? Well, the lingua franca, that's Latin, of the Roman world was not Latin but Greek. Hellenization. You learned about that in grade school, right? Hellenization, the spread of Greek culture. The Bronze Kingdom that did shatter and stop the silver, yeah, because, and that all has everything to do with Xerxes and the Battle of the 300 and it was Thermopylae, right, and in a number of other battles as well, that kind of weaken the third great king of kings of Persia, and so that the Greeks then out of Macedonia later are able to come back, and Alexander unites them, and they conquer the world. And then Alexander dies, and the world gets divided into four other kingdoms, out of which rises Rome. And Rome is then really the fourth actual kingdom. So these smaller kingdoms, they're not world kingdoms. Yeah, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. Although they're going to be, when we see the other visions, we're going to see these guys coming about a little bit. But the fourth, the legs of iron with feet that are mingled with clay, this is Rome. And the understanding that Daniel gives us here also says something about this kingdom, strong as iron. And as you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay, it shall be a divided kingdom. Now, there you actually get him saying this one's divided, yeah? But some of the firmness of iron shall be in it, just as you saw iron mixed with the clay. And the toes of the feet were partly iron, partly clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong, partly brittle. So they will mix with one another in marriage, but they will not hold together, just as iron does not mix with clay. So what was crazy about that then? I do not think that the United States is an extension of this kingdom. I don't buy that at all. This kingdom gets destroyed by the pebble. We're going to come to that. And the whole thing is a picture of the world power in general. So in that sense, every nation, every place is an extension of this. But I'll tell you what Rome was, that this condemnation from God via Daniel says, is a phrase that's pretty near and dear to at least our pocketbooks as Americans. E pluribus unum, right? Out of many, one. That somehow we're going to melting pot all the cultures together, and we'll have this grand unity by which we shall be able to, as on legs of iron, tramp over the entire world and spread freedom and democracy and all that kind of stuff, right? Right. Well, that Rome wasn't that, but it was. And the point of the message here, the point of the vision, is that you look, yeah, you can have people marry each other from other cultures. That's fine. It's not going to make one world culture. You're not going to be able to get rid of the curse of Babylon, the curse of Babel, the curse of language being broken, the curse of cultures being distinct, the curse of people being afraid of what is not normal to them, what is not like them. And so no matter what you do, as strong as you get, you will also be equally brittle at the place you expect it the least. Yeah? Now look, O King of Kings, Daniel goes on, right? You're seeing into the future with this dream. You're seeing yourself, you're seeing a great nation that will rise after you, you're seeing an empire to come after them, and you're seeing an empire to come after them. And then you saw something else, did you not, in the brittleness and the weakness of what made them not just not coal, gold, but even iron mixed with clay and their arrogance and their folly. You saw that little tiny rock. You saw it come flying right down to the least expected of places, a place which was not mixed with the iron as it should have been. A little town of Bethlehem, you Jewish people, you just will not join with the Romans. You hate the tax collectors so much. And there you see the God of heaven setting up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed. Nor shall the kingdom be left to another people. For it shall break in pieces all these kingdoms and bring them all to an end, and it shall stand forever, even as the stone that was cut. As you ran and fled from that collapsing statue, it grew. Now, this hasn't how it happened, right? It was all one dream, but just imagine. So this night, after hearing the understanding, Nebuchadnezzar goes back in to bed. He lies down and says, okay, and he's back on that plane, and he's standing beside the collapsed statue. The golden head is at his feet. He can see the legs out in front of him, and behind, right where the statue was, there's not a pebble there. There's a mountain. A mountain that, I mean, you want to compare a building to a mountain, the highest skyscrapers we have don't even come close to our smallest mountains. Mountains are ginormous. There's a mountain there, a mountain made by no human hand, which has crushed indeed, ground into dust, all these other kingdoms of the earth. Now, again, Daniel is really actually just saying this in the courtroom. This great God has made known to you, Nebuchadnezzar, what shall be. And I can just see Daniel taking his hand and reaching out and grabbing that sword that's right at his neck, putting his hand around the sword, maybe squeezing. It's bleeding a little, but he moves the sword away, and he pushes it down to his side, still looking at the king the entire time as he finishes and says, the word is sure, and the understanding is without question. Like, there had to be silence in that room. All these other wise men kind of hanging on this. Their lives hang on this. They want him to be right. But they're not going to like what happens because he's right. The king is just marveling at this. I mean, it's unbelievable what happens next. He tries to get up off his throne, and he stumbles to his knees, and he's on the ground. He kind of crawls across the ground on his knees to Daniel, where he lies down prostrate on his face at the feet of Daniel. Dude, this guy had never done this in his entire life to anybody. Maybe his dad, maybe, but no. He lies down at the feet of Daniel, prostrate, not worshiping him. And we know this. I mean, the word does mean pays divine homage, but we also know that Daniel would not have received it. You might think of there's other places in history, Paul and Barnabas, are worshipped at Lystra. Peter is shown worship for a moment by Cornelius. They don't accept it, right? So, well, Daniel accepts this, and we know Daniel's not one to accept things that break the law. So it's not divine worship, but it's recognizing that the God who made this known, whom he has just confessed, is indeed the true God. And whether Nebuchadnezzar knows it or not, he is now, for the first time, bowing down before this God, kneeling on his knees before this God. Now, the whole room just had to be in utter shock at this. Then he gets up and he declares that incense be burned to Daniel. Again, an offering, a sacrifice, but we're going to say it's an unbloody sacrifice, and it was not truly to Daniel, but a recognition of Daniel's God and the power that stood behind Daniel. It is, in fact, his own praise of God. He's giving voice to the praise of God. Truly, your God is God of gods and Lord of kings, revealer of mysteries, for you have been able to do this. Now, before we go into what happens next, I've mentioned the conversion of King Nebuchadnezzar being the story, but don't be mistaken. He's not converted yet. This is only the beginning. This is not a one-to-one knock on your door. If you die tonight, will you go to heaven? Now pray the sinner's prayer with me. Conversion. This is a slow drag where now he knows the true God is the true God, but he has not given up on the idea that there are many gods. So when he calls him God of gods, he doesn't mean like the other gods aren't real. He just means that this God's bigger. Well, this will come back. This is a slow conversion. But he is confessing the true God as well. It's the first step. And he makes Daniel, let's put ourselves in the feet of the other chief magi that are standing there watching. They're like, oh, thank God we're alive. You know, oh, this kid, this is great. Good kid. Slap him on the back. And then just as they're doing that, the king's like, don't touch him. He's your boss now. Daniel, I make you to be in charge of all the Chaldeans. You are now in charge of all the wise men. You're in charge of everything. The highest of the schools, you're the boss. You are the precept. You are the manager and overseer of all these. And I can't imagine that his former teachers took that very well. Wait, what? This guy who doesn't even believe half the stuff that we taught him to write on the test, now he's in charge? What? But that's what happens. Daniel becomes the vice regent or the prefect, the one who is over all the Chaldeans. Now, that doesn't mean that he's like the right-hand man of the king, per se. So some of the language in English makes it sound like he just was a generalized ruler. He would have had authority and would have had influence in that, but he really was put over the schools and put over the houses of those who served as priests and magical function and all that kind of stuff. So now you have a guy who won't do magic running the magic people. And then Daniel also, the text is a little awkward to read here. I mean, the ESV says, Daniel made a request of the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon, but Daniel remained at the king's court. The way that reads, it sounds like there's kind of two ways it goes. Daniel actually didn't accept the position. They split it into three and then let those guys do it instead. Or that Daniel had these guys kind of sent off away from Babylon in order to like serve other parts of the kingdom, which doesn't make sense given what's going to happen next. It's more like, you know, when you get made president of the United States, you have to put together a cabinet. The cabinet is a public set of officials who come in and they have authority, but they're right there kind of with you usually. So you have the cabinet, and then you also have your staff as well, right? And your staff has authority to do things that they're given. So somewhere between, you know, him having Shadrach be his chief of staff and Meshach be his marketing manager, somewhere between that and them being, say, Secretary of Education, right? Secretary of Horoscopes, Secretary of Incanting, and Secretary of Whispering, right? Somewhere in there, that's what happens. Like, it's like, okay, this is a big job. I can't do it by myself. I need some help. Hey, King, appoint these guys too. And so, oh man, how far have they come overnight? These guys are sitting at home wondering if Daniel's ever going to come back. They just prayed all night that Daniel would be able to see what the king had dreamed, Well, that sounds pretty crazy. And then tell it to the king and help him understand it. And next thing you know, there's an assassin at the door again, and Daniel's not there. And he's like, come with me. But instead of taking them to death, he takes them to these like high quality rooms. And you know, they change their clothes and they get brought in before the king, and they're being anointed to levels of position at court. Yeah. And so over the province of Babylon, the affairs of Babylon, well, that just means that they were had extended roles that went from the king's court out, or from the magi's palaces and whatever, out into the area around. And they were an extension of Daniel's own authority and power. Now, you know, this didn't make Malfoy very happy at all, right? He's watching Harry suddenly made headmaster, and then Hermione and Ron are made heads of houses, right? Or put in charge of potions or whatever. I mean, Snape would have been just furious. Yeah. So that's kind of the place they find themselves in. That all those Philistine kids and those Phoenician kids who've graduated with them and are also living in kind of those more squalid quarters and have to work their way up at the cubicle job. And now these guys are leaving the cubicle and they're up in the top office. Like, this is not setting up Everyone Loves You. But for the moment, as you're brought into these offices, you're kind of, hey, cool. And you're good at it. You've already demonstrated that. You graduated summa cum laude, right? You're doing good. So you go to work. You start working for Babylon. And so far as you can tell, right, everything's fine. You've found ways to help kind of navigate the distinction between the pagan religion and the knowledge that they had scientifically. Makes me think of, I've been kind of into mindfulness the last year or so, and there certainly is danger in mindfulness. There are people who teach it, and it is false religion. But then there is also something very valuable about sitting there and breathing for 10 minutes and focusing your attention on your breath. And you can do it. You can do it as a Christian. There's nothing wrong with watching your breath for 10 minutes with your eyes closed. There's nothing pagan about that. So they were able to like see that difference somehow, and then began to, can you only imagine, begin to actually apply that to the civilization. This was a boon. This was a gift to the civilization of Babylon. But let's go back to Nebuchadnezzar. He's got his face on the floor, kissing the stone. And he gets up and he worships the God of gods with all his pagan rites, which are in fact wrongheaded. They're the wrong rites, but he does it. He burns the unholy incense and all this stuff to him. And then he comes in and he knights these guys and sends them off to do their stuff. And then he goes back on his throne. He's like, okay, well, honestly, I'm going to take a nap today. Next morning, a whole day later, he's feeling a little better. He knows that the God of gods has told him that he is a golden head on a statue that will be the greatest or the highest point of all human civilization ever. And this picture of this golden-headed statue just stays with him. It stays with me. He can't shake it. And he starts to think, well, since that's who I am, should I not make it known to the world that that's who I am? And he gets this idea that he's going to go ahead and build a giant statue made of gold with a head that looks just like his. Maybe not like his, but like his, yes. And he sets to work. You know, he's got other guys running other stuff for him. He doesn't have to worry about the magi anymore. He sets to work planning this. And we're going to zoom a little ahead in the story, come back and pick it up next time. But this massive, giant, gold-plated statue that he sets up in the plain of Dura for the day of his consecration. He calls all the various officials of all the region together. And he's got to be really proud. I mean, look at this. The God of gods has consecrated him king, and here is the sign of his kingship. And so now, everyone who is anyone needs to acknowledge that the God of gods has chosen to smile on the gods of Babylon. And so worship the gods of Babylon and thereby give glory and honor to the true God. So I'm going to play a bunch of music and everyone's going to bow down and all will be well as we recognize the pantheon which has brought us to this place. See, you see, it's called synergism. Oh, I got it wrong there. It's called syncretism. Synergism is works righteousness. Syncretism is the blending together of multiple religions in order to make them one. And it's a very anti-Christian practice. And to make the long story short, we'll pick it up next time. He's so proud. He's so excited. He's getting it all together. His kingdom's what it's supposed to be. There will be other kingdoms that come, but none will be like him. And they will all have to look at this statue and remember who he was. And so he has the music played and everybody bows down. And well, he doesn't see this. But there's these three guys who just came out of the office. They were working in their corner offices all morning, but they heard, oh, we got to go down. There's this big ceremony today. Everyone else take a lunch break. We'll be back in a couple hours. They head down and they hear that they're just there and they hear this proclamation being read. Everyone's got to bow down to this statue and worship Bel, the god of Babylon. What's going on? And the music plays and they look at each other like, well, we can't do that. See, and the king doesn't see it. The king's bowed down himself, but you know who sees it? You know who's standing right beside Shadrach? And Malfoy. He's right there. He's right there, and now, well, he doesn't have to solemnly swear, but he's gonna be up to no good.
Was that worth a dollar? What about five? Project Resurrection is made possible by listeners like you and your patronage of my husband's work. Click the Patreon link in the show notes to sign up. Pretty please?